Welcome to yet another episode of Innovation Odyssey. Today I have with me several ponds away, the fantastic Rohit Jha, who is the founder and CEO, co-founder and CEO at Tram Celestial. Welcome, Rohit.
Thank you, Renu. It's great to see you again after a few days.
Yes, it's funny how the world works, huh?
The magic of the internet.
Yes. Oh, that's, we are on topic immediately. But I love to start always with asking my guests who they are and what they do, and in a 30-second elevator pitch. So please go ahead.
Sure. Hi, I'm Rohit, and I run Transcelestial. Transcelestial is a company which is created a new technology which uses lasers to transmit internet worldwide. And in the long run, we are trying to build an interplanetary internet using lasers to Moon, Mars, and beyond.
Oh, that's succinct and exciting. So I have to ask, Why lasers?
Well, the question is not lasers. The question is that, like, why does internet still suck in so many parts of the world? And that was really the kind of thread that we pulled on. And I grew up in a small part of India, in a small town in India, which was the internet was really provided by the government entities there, and it was just horrible. And the first time I truly saw what internet and high speed internet especially could do was when I moved to Singapore for my undergraduate studies, right? And Singapore is fantastic. It's one of the world's best in places where you can have internet connection. And that 0-to-1 moment, both for me and my co-founder, was when things like collaboration, things like education, whether it's through YouTube or other kind of dense kind of mediums, and just the wealth of access of high bandwidth information that it gives you, access to banking, access to other services, that changed us. And really what we want is that effect for most of the world that's out there. Now, most of the big companies tell you that more than 50% of the world is unconnected, which is actually quite wrong. So I spend a lot of my time doing being part of a team which was doing electronic trading for one of the banking companies here, and you get exposed to how the internet really works. And really, the internet is a network of networks, basically. More than 99% of the world's data goes through these undersea cables, which then come up to continents, and they are distributed to cities with fiber optic cables. And then once it reaches a city, it then is distributed to homes, offices, cell towers, etc. And you can just by my definition describing that, you can imagine how complex it is. They have hundreds of thousands of kind of companies worldwide trying to make this work with all misaligned incentives. And then you have the government with variations and regulations and stuff. And so that's why internet sucks in most places. It's that the distribution of the internet is a bottleneck. And it's not that 50% of the world is unconnected. You have 2G in the remotest regions of India and Africa. But most of the world, more than 50%, is underconnected, which means you don't have access to high-speed internet at cheap prices and with low latency to the cloud. Things like these, what we are doing, video call, is enabled by our low latency and high bandwidth to the cloud. So that's what we are trying to fix. And the big reason is fiber is expensive to roll out everywhere. And by using wireless fibers, which is effectively lasers, you can speed up how quickly these towns, these cities, these homes, these offices, etc., can be meshed and connected effectively.
So if we see the Transcelestial universe come into dominance, are we going to see no more fiber? Or is it going to be that fiber and laser will coexist?
Yeah, I mean, like, absolutely coexist, right? Like, I mean, it's a tool in the toolbox, and it's a very strong tool that is driving, in my opinion, a lot of where the civilization is going. It's the same way we have diesel cars, petrol cars, electric cars, and there's a different reason for all of those to exist. So fiber today is still quite important. Under the sea, connecting two major continents, you have terabytes of data flowing through per second. And that kind of capability is yet to be unlocked in laser comms, as we call it, laser communications and stuff. Not because the technology doesn't support it, because the technology we have, which is lasers transmitting data, is the same technology you have inside a fiber core, right? You have lasers running inside a fiber. And what we have done is taken that out of the fiber. But it's the surrounding technology to make that laser communication work, right? And so we'll get there. It's on a roadmap. And we are one of the only companies kind of driving that like high bandwidth stuff. So I think we'll get there eventually. But for the time being, I think fiber and lasers will coexist. And there's also a natural progression to technology adoption, right? Like we're not going to become like a... Like not everyone's going to suddenly jump onto electric cars, and there's going to be a natural phase of transition to that. And it's the same with lasers and fiber and stuff. Yeah. But having said that, for civilization and humanity to expand beyond Earth's confines, we cannot lay fiber optics in space. So as humanity goes beyond Earth's atmosphere, laser communications is the only default way to deliver connectivity in deep space. And so that will become the default of our civilization going ahead. Yeah.
I see. So you're really kind of setting the base for the only way to communicate to space now, picking up on whatever on the, I would say, the low-hanging fruit on Earth and then going to space.
Yeah, I mean, like the idea was like if whatever technologies we dream up, right, for our civilization, if it's a technology of the future, it should be able to solve today's problems as well, right? And so that's been the thesis, yeah.
And in terms of cost, what's the difference between fiber and laser for comms?
Yeah, very good. So typically when you try to lay fiber, let's say, between two buildings for broadband or something like that, the typical cost is divided into CapEx and OpEx. So for those who don't know the difference, it's capital expenditure, which is one time, and then operating expenditure, which kind of reoccurs or either frequently or infrequently. So for fiber, the capital expenditure is the cost of the fiber itself. Plus the cost of like any other kind of like tools and materials and stuff you need to dig the ground and put the fiber inside or the ducts and things like that. And then you have the operating cost, which is basically the hiring of services of people who will be there on the ground to put fiber in, and then also recurring costs of when you're putting fiber through land, you are renting that land from either the government or a private individual. So you have to pay them rent, right? So that's the ongoing operating cost. And so these are things which kind of collectively form the cost of fiber optics deployment, right? And that's why cities like Singapore and countries like Korea, which are small and dense enough and can make that investment nationwide, have been able to densify fiber. But almost every other country worldwide, it's extremely impossible to make fiber that dense with that density. It's too expensive. So compared to that, what we have is basically two boxes, size of a shoe. Let's say you want to connect two buildings. You put one box on one building, one on the other, and they have built-in AI which tracks each other, finds and shoots a laser to connect. So and creates a virtual fiber through which you can send data, right? So it's like a wireless virtual link. Real link, sorry, not virtual, but it's a wireless real link, and it acts like a virtual fiber, effectively. So the cost-wise, the difference typically is this. Depending whether you are city or rural, the costs change because the cost of land is different in cities versus rural areas. But it can range, and also countries is different. So costs of US are different from Asia versus India, etc. So typically, I'll just give you a broad range. It can range somewhere between $30,000 per kilometer to places like Singapore, where it goes up to $150,000 per kilometer. And I'm talking about US dollar numbers effectively here. And that's per kilometer costs for rolling out fiber optic networks. For us, for laser comms, that cost is around $6,000 per kilometer. And that is not the only thing. The other major advantage is time cost of opportunity. Life is short, and you can't, typically a fiber would take somewhere between 3 to 4 weeks to, in some cases, and in some of our clients, 6 months to a year, even 2 years to get rolled out to certain cell towers or buildings. Because again, you have so many people involved, there's regulations involved, you have to convince someone to give up their land. These are all shifting variables. And then there's supply chain to take care of, right? But for us, it's like literally you find two places that can see each other. and then you just, or even if you can't see each other, use relays, and then you just like go, boom, you just shoot straight like as the crow flies, and you sync up and you connect. So literally almost a lot of our installations, we have done it in less than half a day, some in less than an hour, and you can get communities building cell towers connected instantly.
And how many people do you need to deploy in a new place, your technology in a new place?
Yeah, so that, I mean, this is the kind of one of the underlying factors for total cost of ownership. Like our CapEx costs are just the boxes, and our OPEX costs, unlike fiber, where you need an army of people digging and protecting and laying. For us, typically, it's just one person. So they go up on one building or cell tower, they'll put the box, screw it tight, they go to the next one, put up a box, screw it tight, and that's it. And both the boxes find each other and connect, start streaming. That's it.
So you make it sound really simple, and I know it's not simple. But why did this technology come now, or why is it gaining some traction now as to, say, 5 years ago?
Yeah, good question. I mean, like, you are right. And I don't want in any way or means to sound like, oh, this is just like absolutely easy. There are certain complications, obviously, with our technology as well. And it's like, for example, like when I said someone goes up a building, we also see time where they have usually access to rooftops of buildings is restricted. So you have to get approvals from building management and stuff. So it does take time. Like, it's not that we deliver those to our clients and the next day it's all up, right? Like, There's still some amount of kind of legwork needed operationally to get it done, but comparatively it's less. That was the point I was trying to drive.
Okay.
There's many for technology to kind of thrive. I mean, I always say like it's all about the right timing and the right needs that emerge mm-hmm. during that timing, right? So the right timing comes from, I mean, basically, actually, it all boils down to right timing. That's it. Like in our civilization, so. To be honest, it's a small history lesson. So lasers were invented back in the 60s by Bell Labs, mm-hmm. and which was a research arm for legendary research arm for AT&T. And they were looking into lasers because during the World War II and after that, radio frequency and micro was being used for communication across the globe and sending messages to troops and stuff. And it was quite low bandwidth. It was all constantly being jammed, and it was a security issue and things like that. And AT&T was setting up the first radio cell tower, not cell tower, but radio tower network across the US. So they thought of the idea of like, you know what, let's go up the electromagnetic spectrum to light. And based on Shannon's theorem of how much data you can pack into any electromagnetic wave, it seems like with light, there was just like millions of times more data rate that you could get effectively, right? And so they invented the laser. The first laser was the size of this massive table effectively. And so they were like, okay, shit, we can't put this on a tower. This is huge. So obviously what was invented was a fiber optic cable, like kind of like a sheath around the protective sheath around the laser to carry the signal, right? Now, what happened since then was fiber optic cable is just silica gel, right? Like, so you create this like transparent silica tubes, and silica sand is everywhere. So it's quite cheap to build that. So famously, one of our professors used to say in uni that a kilometer of noodle is more expensive than a kilometer of fiber. But the raw costs of that, right? Like, so fiber got very famous. And over time, in the 70s, maybe 80s, what ended up happening was that big laser, which was being that generated lasers using like ionized gas, that was collapsed into a semiconductor diode, actually. So once you go from that to this, again, a lot of Defense Department funding and that kind of things and driving things in that direction. Once you get to something that's on the size of a pin, right, then suddenly it becomes quite easy to reimagine the origins of what the purpose for even getting lasers in the first place was. So since the 80s, what has happened is companies like BAE, Lockheed, Northrop, and some of these big defense contractors across US, UK, Japan, they have been secretly building, not secretly, but like internally, they have laser comms programs, even Airbus, to use it for the Defense Department. It's because the Defense Department can spend So these are these like hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars of laser communication programs, customized hardware, customized software, customized compute, FPGA, GPUs, etc. And so to make those decisions that you need to point the laser exactly and stuff. So all the latest stealth fighters would get that kind of technology and that sort of stuff. And so that was one area. The second area was, as I said, in space, lasers is the only way forward for us as a civilization. So NASA put this on the roadmap that by 2010 it was initially, then got shifted to 2020, now it's 2030. But the idea was that eventually we will phase out the current way of connecting in space, which is radio waves, to more like laser comms. And that would be the default for all space agencies. So very heavy research, high funding kind of organizations. And what has happened is there's three or four subsystems you need to build laser comms. You need ability to transmit data into light. You need a lot of compute for stabilizing the laser and making those decisions in real time. Energy efficient compute, I would say. And you need obviously miniaturized technology, which comes at a cheap cost to be able to commercialize that, right? You can't do custom hardware for when you are trying to build like internet worldwide. So fast forward to 2015, 2016, December 2016 was when we launched the company. And 3 months before launching the company, Dinesh and I met at this accelerator called Entrepreneur First. These guys bring individuals together who then start a company together. And these are usually deep tech individuals. So around that time, I was already kicking around the idea of like deep space laser comms and energy transmission and that kind of stuff using lasers. And what became evident was for the first time in decades, all the subsystems needed to make this technology in a commercial packaging, commercial price point where you can DFM it, which means design for manufacturing it for large scale. So you can slap it on a production line and scale the volume to such high volumes that you can put that on every cell tower, every building worldwide, right? So that became very clear that technology at the subsystem and component level was there. But we had to piece that together from various industries, from ranging from astronomy to biomedical to fiber optics industry to various industries where we saw these components have reached scale and we could pull that together effectively. And then, of course, we had to apply a lot of our AI and algorithms effectively to make sure that these sensors worked in the way we wanted it to work together and put it in a commercialized, design for manufacturing packaging. And that has now become Centauri, which is our first mass-produced commercial version. And today we operate Terabit Factory in Singapore, which is capable of producing 2,400 terminals annually of these laser terminals. Now, at one point, this is more terminals than so far all of the history of laser terminals combined. And that we can do in less than a year now. In production. So that's the shift that's happened. Now, so as I say, it's all about like converging things. So while technology converged and the price points converged, the other side was demand. So we are transitioning now from 4G to 5G. And this was literally on our first slide deck. And we said, look, there's a rise of cloud, which happened around 2013 to 2015 when 4G came in full force. We were using cloud apps, everything is being delivered from the cloud, your experiences, our photos get synced back into the cloud. If you lose your phone today, no one cares. You'll just like download the whole thing from the cloud anymore, right? Yes. Well, hopefully if you have backed up. Have you backed up, Renu? Did you back up your phone?
I learned my lesson.
Okay. Yes, please. The cloud is everything now. But that was the whole point. Like as a civilization, we all talk about exponential. Oh, this rate of growth of Bitcoin is exponential. And this is exponential. Energy needs are exponential. The reality is almost everything in our life are sigmoidal, which means that it's an S-curve. So we are seeing a small portion of it, so it feels exponential. But when you zoom out, things flatten out, right? Except there's very, very few things which are actually truly exponential. And one of them is data creation. As a civilization, we will always create more data than we have created in the past. We'll always transact with more data than we have created in the past. that is a beast that cannot be turned back anymore. So keeping that in mind, the idea was that drove the demand side of things basically for us. And for the first time, the need for such a high bandwidth medium for transmitting has become clear and required and is urgent now. Everyone needs high bandwidth internet connections. And for the first time, you cannot rely on microwaves or copper lines and things like that anymore. You have to go to lasers, whether inside a fiber or outside a fiber. Does that make sense, by the way?
Yes, it's beautiful. I love the history lesson because now I kind of, you know, I had some ideas about why now. And mine was more like, you know, there is a product that is being made, which is phones, 4G, 5G, they're building stuff and someone's need to, right? So I see a little bit of that, but I also see the supply side completely working out.
And there's just one more thing quickly that I would add, like in terms of the funding coming into this whole industry. Today, the telecommunication services industry is a $1 trillion+ market, out of which $970+ billion market is just broadband, effectively. And one of the big things that you're seeing there is last year, one of the big signal events, I would say, was when Biden's administration announced that, well, internet in the US sucks. Most of the people don't have access to good quality, cheap internet. And so they are pumping in close to, I think commitment, if I'm not wrong, is just $40+ billion over the next decade. That's going to go into just all the ISPs and internet providers who can put fiber or equivalent infrastructure, whether wired or wireless, to get to a certain broadband level, uploads and download speeds to every home, every office, every person in the US market. And that kind of capital dump into such a unique infrastructure problem connected to internet has never happened before, right? And so again, so there's all these factors which are just converging at this point in time. Plus, of course, we have Starship that's getting launched. We have SpaceX doing amazing launches. We have folks here, Equatorial Space in Singapore. We have tons of rocket companies which are getting us to orbit. And a future where humanity is multiplanetary has been a nerd dream for everyone growing up. And we are finally able to realize that within our own lifetimes. And so that's also another exciting reason why we need to mature and sustain these technologies and grow these technologies today. So we are ready for that future coming up.
And one question I was thinking about is, how does laser do when, say, you're in the deserts of Arizona? Because the buildings are not so close by as the skyscrapers of New York. Does it do equally well, better?
So in most of the cities are great, by the way, because most of the cities we have access to tall cell towers, or we have access to building rooftops and stuff where the cell towers usually go. So you always have kind of line of sight to something in the city. And the other reason is, as we're transitioning from 4G to 5G, like bulk of our customers are telecom customers. And the biggest use case we have is we work with them to extend the reach of their high bandwidth cell towers. So instead of doing fiber, we'll take wherever fiber has come to and then extend using laser and then a laser to the next tower, laser to the next tower. So 5G itself is a near line of sight technology. You kind of need a person with our cell phone to have a kind of line of sight to one, at least two cell towers. So whenever we deploy with our customers, even in cities, we get line of sight and we can do a mesh effectively.
And so the reason that that's why it's called last mile.
Yeah. So we do last mile. That's why it's last mile. It's basically from wherever in a city, there's usually some fiber infrastructure. Maybe it's 20% or 30% spread in the city. So we'll take wherever it is and then start expanding wirelessly from there.
You operate in Singapore and other countries such as?
Yeah, actually, surprisingly, we don't need this technology in Singapore because every house has fiber optics here. So it's a bit annoying. Okay. But the reality is, like, it's a perfect place to build this technology and a team where you can pull people from all over the world. It's an amazing density of great individuals. But yeah, our real business is Southeast Asia. So Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines. Then North Asia, Taiwan, Then South Asia, India, we do a lot of work. And then most recently, around 6 months ago or so, we've just entered the US market. And we are soon to announce within the next few days or so, we'll be announcing that we are working with all, with a few major telcos there already within the last 6 months. And we've just finished deploying our technology to provide live 4G coverage to one of the biggest kind of live events on the West Coast. Yeah, once the kind of NDA lifts from that, so we'll be able to share more. But it's a huge win for us there. So.
And is US like your real on your roadmap? Is US what is planned for the next 1 to 2 years?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, as I said, like first because there's huge amounts of focus and attention going into the broadband infrastructure improvement there, and the amount of capital and the dedication committed there by FCC is bigger than almost any regulator worldwide today. So it's definitely an area we want to be in. I mean, US is always super exciting to be in. So that's part one, but it also a lot of the long-term stuff like things like space, things like working with some of the defense and intelligence community there for our technologies. So all of this really ties in into a market that's huge for us and it's huge for our company. So absolutely. That's definitely an area we want to be in.
When is space on your roadmap?
Secretly, it's been there since day one. there's been so much we have been quietly doing in space that it's not on our website or anywhere. You'd have to buy me a beer and we can sit and discuss more about that. But long story short, like a lot of our team is ex-space and defense, and a lot of the it's literally from day one, even if you like pick out some of our patents and you read the patents, you would see like space use case and stuff. So every single thing we have built in the company is with our internal product design meetings are basically like, okay, how would this work if it was just like these two things out in space, right? Like basically there's nothing else around it and stuff, right? Like, and so a lot of the thinking has gone behind that, except obviously when we were designing for our technology to compensate for rain and snow and things, weather effects and stuff. But all the other algorithms and decision-making are with that mindset. A lot of the form factor and heat dissipation stuff and things like that is with space in mind. So it's always been there. The why space is quite interesting. And if I may just quickly pull on that. While some of our current technologies is great for us to connect cities and within cities, but because the Earth curves, there's beyond, after a certain amount of distance, you can't get straight line of sight effectively, right, to things. So the fastest way to actually route connections is to go up in orbit and then route down from there, right? And that's also the lower latency and much better and stuff. So today space is being used for just two main use cases, for bouncing signals around the planet and for looking at the planet. And one of those markets is basically 100 times bigger or 500 times bigger than the other business market. So telecommunications is huge. So we want to use space as a way for us to route high bandwidth data to places which don't have that at a better latency, better bandwidth, and more securely. And then, of course, once you are in space, you then use that platform to then venture into deep space effectively, right? So that's effectively the idea. The idea is to kind of try to build a high bandwidth telecommunication and cloud infrastructure in space with orbital data centers being able to store cache, compute data in orbit, and then drop it directly into cities and towns and villages at a much better latency and cost numbers than undersea cables. So that's where the company is kind of going to and heading towards. And in the next, I would say we would be making some announcements this year on that area, and then full-fledged beta services to customers will start next year. So that means we have been secretly doing a lot of stuff.
Oh, that's good. That's excellent. I'll get you that beer so that we can chat more on this. And going back a little now to the personal stuff, you have a very interesting background. You mentioned a brief stint at a bank.
Mm.
Did I hear that right?
That's correct.
How did that that led you into space or into laser
comms? I think like So it has, working at a bank was like positive and negative. So for those of you who don't know, so when people think about bank, they think about like the place where I store my money. And typically banks are just so much bigger than the retail side of the bank, right? So I was working at RBS. To be honest, if today I have to go back to any other bank in this world, that would still be the same bank I'd go back to. Like it had, while I had, so when I graduated NTU with an engineering degree, I had options to go to UBS and RBS and McKinsey. And at that point in time, I had to make a call. So consulting was straight up out. I mean, I just didn't want to get into consulting and wanted to use technology more rather than write presentations. So at the banking level, the culture defines quite a lot. And the people at RBS are some of the best that I've met. All I've learned about leadership is from leaders, watching leaders operate there and drive innovation and things like that. So absolutely some of the best people I've met in life, both from engineering management point of view. But what ends up happening is, so I was in what they call the investment banking side of the vertical. So you have corporate banking, retail banking, and then investment banking, right? And then IB is split into pure IB, where you do M&A kind of things and then M&A transactions. And then you have the markets side of the things, where you are looking at equities market and foreign exchange and fixed income and these kind of verticals where you trade and you hedge and you price effectively. So I was on the foreign exchange side, electronic markets. When I joined, most of the trading was still done using voice and manual traders and putting trades in and stuff. And like over the course of 4 years that I was there, I worked in Singapore and London. Over that course of 4 years, I saw things go from 10% electronic trades to 99% electronic trades. And like slowly the manual traders just slowly being like, okay, thank you, we don't need you anymore kind of over time. And of course, now this is 2011 to 2015, right? So that was a great part. But what ends up happening is like you're working these really long hours on things which are quite repetitive over time. And after a period, I kind of pushed a lot of like kind of initiatives. So back in 2012, when Bitcoin was like, no one knew what it was, I wrote an internal paper, just to give you an example, on this magical technology underlying Bitcoin, which is called blockchain, explained what cryptographic transfers mean and hashing means, and said that as a bank, we could use it. As a foreign exchange team, we could use it to have our internal coin. And what that means is that at the edges, whenever our customers and brokers transact with us, it changes to RBS coin, and all our systems and technology and risk management models and stuff, they operate on a single currency, and you internalize those transactions. And by doing some back of the envelope, you would save easily just by doing that, like tens of millions of pounds of operational costs just by doing that. So again, like that was just like dusted and kept to the side. That's great. Good job with this paper and get back to work, right? And then 2016 came and JP Morgan launched the first, I think JP Morgan was the first one to launch their coin, internal coin. So there was many other examples like that. And then at some point you realize that there are many industries, like I'm sad to say insurance is one of that, banking is one of that, where you innovate when you feel threatened and your business model and your revenue stream is threatened. And given we all live very short lives, the idea was that I would rather be in an industry where I don't know where we are going. You can't search the Google for answers or ChatGPT for answers now. And you have to kind of figure out what it means to kind of build in that area. And space has, I was working on space projects back in uni and stuff. And so space has always been the final frontier, the endless frontier. Science is the endless frontier, as Vannevar Bush says. So that's the idea, was to kind of pour myself back into that. Yeah.
Okay. And how influential has Singapore been in molding you to be the person you are? And the reason is, of course, this is a podcast about global entrepreneurs. So what do you think has been the role of Singapore?
Yeah, good question. It's always changed. I mean, I can talk historically what Singapore contributed. And of course, things change, ecosystems change, and cities and things morph to take different roles depending on timing. But Singapore, I had spent, as of now, I've spent like more than 16 years in Singapore. And when I started the company, it was over a decade. And at that point in time, it was quite clear, or close to a decade. At that point in time, it was quite clear that most of my networks and my second degree connections were in this part of the world. So if I was pulling talent in or pulling capital in, or just the way business is done, and if I had to get to, like, let's say, a head of telco somewhere or something like that, or a regulator, it would be much easier for me to do that here than any other part. So as a founder, you have to kind of figure out what are the cities, towns, or places, first of all, that amplify your leverage. And you have to start there, because at the beginning, you have no leverage, basically. No one gives a crap about what you're doing. So it's like, okay, I need, it's a minimizing function on like how many less number of things I need to really build from scratch. And the other things can be just leveraged out of my network or things people. And so Singapore is definitely that for me. And so that's why I decided to start here. And of course, it's a small city, which also means that it's super low latency to unlock some of these things, right? Things move fast, things move quick. If you want to talk to a regulator, so literally like within a day, you will find someone who will introduce you to a minister or something like that. And so you can get things done quickly. If you want to find people, you know, there's this like three universities, you go there and you find the right kind of people, right? So it's fantastic in that sense. Capital is the same. Actually, capital was different when we started. At that point in time, Singapore was very much still in the Web 2.0 phase, where all the investors were really just used to investing in Web 2.0 and like apps and shit, basically. And Uber was the biggest example everyone was giving for innovation. And I'm like, really, it's a database table with like a fancy UI, right? Like it's, but I get it. I mean, like it did unlock certain things and it's great productivity for us, but it's not what it's not building rockets. Basically, like it's not solving hard problems. And I had quit to solve hard problems, basically. And so what ended up happening was basically over time, we had to go to, I would spend hours and hours in VC meetings and investor meetings and stuff, trying to explain to them like how they got internet to their cell phones and homes, because most of the people just don't know. They assume it comes from satellites in space, right? Reality is less than 1% comes from satellites in space. So it was really a lot of education of the ecosystem. And then even if they got that, the idea always was like, okay, hardware is too hard. Like that's the thing I keep hearing. And it's deep tech is like too difficult, right? Like, and your capital needs are too much in the for the seed round. This looks like a Series A. Go to the Series A guys. And Series A guys will be like, well, you have no customers. So go back to the seed guys, right? Like, and I'm like, guys, come on. And luckily, Seeds Capital, which is Singapore government's investment arm. So Singapore government is the single largest deep tech investor in Southeast Asia. And the way they do that is they co-match funds in the early stage with a lot of VCs and say, look, if you think this area is risky, I will come in, whether that's biomedical, whether that's deep tech. I'll come in, I'll give you a dollar, you put in a dollar, and then you go about and basically fund these companies. And later on in the future, guess what? When you want to buy back my, you can buy back my share and you will buy it back at the original share price, not the latest one. So this is a great incentive for funds. And they obviously choose and pick the funds they want in that program and things like that. So Wavemaker stepped up and they led our round. And since then, the pre-seed seed market for deep tech is massive. There's tons of funds here, great angel network. Here. People understand that hard tech and deep tech is the industry that you want to invest in. Because 9 out of 10 times, that's what's resilient to a fluctuating market. That's what's resilient to an inflating market. And your investments are a lot more secure in such things, right? And that's where like you're changing the defaults of something. So that has improved. So that's what helped us in the early days, right? Getting the right kind of capital. It took time, but we got that. But then we were able to attract talent worldwide, because the government also made it very easy for us to get employment visas. Super easy. They were like, look, the kind of people we are talking about is there are 5 people in the world who have that skill set who can align laser beams to a millidegree accuracy, right? Like one of them was working for LIGO, another one for European Space Agency. And so we pulled those people in and things like that. So they made it easy to get visas. They made it easy to get capital. Eventually, they made it easy to us that we don't have to pay any like corporate taxes, or individuals had to pay very, very low personal taxes, which means as an engineer, we pay them Silicon Valley roughly salaries, and they are taking home, instead of paying 40% taxes, they pay less than 5% or 8%. So they're taking home like so much more. And the quality of life is amazing in Singapore, as you have seen, right? Like, it's fantastic. So those things helped. But it's getting tougher now at the growth stage. At the growth stage, again, it's 5 years in. We are one of the most mature deep tech companies in the ecosystem. And now, again, I'm seeing the same thing that I saw 5 years ago, that there's a lack of understanding, there's a lack of capital at this stage and stuff. And so so that's why we are looking also at US, because the understanding is there. So we can get some learnings from there and people from there. We can then come and educate the market here and work with the cap table here to grow that a bit more. And one good example I can mention just to close this off is InQtel. So InQtel is a strategic investment arm for the US, a few of the US government agencies and stuff. And we were one of the first companies outside the US market in Asia that they invested in. And in the last year, they have opened up an office in Singapore, and since then they have invested in more such companies. But these guys absolutely were the first checks in Anduril, the first checks in SpaceX and these kind of folks. So they understand what it means to back and grow deep tech companies and get them commercial and government contracts, which are big, and make them big. And they, we have a guy now here, Justin, who is driving a lot of that education in the ecosystem, which is great.
Wonderful. And another question is, do you consider yourself an entrepreneur or an innovator, or both even? The definition is up to you. I love asking my guests questions because everyone has such a different view of it.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, I'm not going to give a very super philosophical answer to this and stuff. But to be honest, like, I don't think, I mean, definitely an entrepreneur, because just by the definition of that, like, I've started a company, right? Like, and that's just the one of the basic definitions of an entrepreneur. But I think the innovator stuff, I will be humble and say that, like, it's it's probably not the case, because a lot of my initial ideas were on the hardware and engineering and stuff were rightfully shot down by smarter engineers than myself. They were like, no, that sucks. And which was great. And but I think I have been innovative in putting the team together and the capital together. And yeah. And the choice of a co-founder who's fantastic, by the way. And so I think, like, it's just, you have to build a company. You have to just, people say, oh, just focus on one or two things. And then, like, you don't need to innovate and change everything else. That's completely bad. That's completely wrong, right? Like, so a product is basically a group of individuals you band together. And culture and how they respond and build things is very important. And everything needs to be looked at if you want that culture to be that. Like, you have to question everything from, like, payroll all the way to, like, what drinks you have in the fridge to everything. Like, of course, you don't want to be spending, like, hours and days on that, but you have to, decisions have to be conscious about some of these things, yeah. Right? Completely. Yeah.
So details matter.
Details matter, absolutely. Yeah, of course, you shouldn't be spending, like, days and days on, like, oh, yeah, which ice cream do I get? No, that's not the plan. But yeah, absolutely, I think. And sometimes, like, I do feel that I have, look, after 6 years of running a company, it's always difficult to find, to be the person, keep bringing in the most original ideas in the team. So that's why you want to facilitate that innovation within the company, right? Like, you want to facilitate that so that tomorrow, if you're hit by a bus, that company and the DNA keeps moving things forward. Good. Right? It doesn't stay.
Yes, thank you for that. And to wrap up, what would be your outlook for lasers and laser comms in space? I know we talked about it a lot, but like a very quick wrap up would be great.
Yeah, interesting. So there's two trends that's already happening, and I think that's what's going to continue. So number one is basically when we started, there was no standardization of what a laser terminal or laser communication looks like, right? Everyone was, because everything was defense and everything was space, and they were doing their own stuff. So we had to choose, okay, what wavelength of light or color of light to choose, what kind of, like, protocol it is, what kind of this the interfaces it should be and stuff. And 3 years later, US government created SDA, Space Development Agency, and they formalized what a laser comm ideal terminal looks like. and it was spec for spec exactly what we had done, right? Like, so that it was great to be validated. And now, because it's an industry kind of standard, at least in the US, there are many companies who are now building to that spec, which is great because we don't have to change a thing, which is great. So that's part one. So part two was also the second part of it. Like, when we started, we were the only ones looking at this from a large-scale manufacturing point of view, right? Like, I mean, the technology, that's why Airbus, who still had a laser comm company through their ventures arm, ended up investing in us, right? Like, they saw something unique and different where we were accelerating a lot of things. So, but fast forward in the last 3 years, what has happened is, I mean, today, if I count across the world, from Japan to China to India to UK to Europe, broader Germany, France, to US, I think Canada as well, there are, I think, roughly more than 50 laser communication companies building this technology across all, and most of them are very, very early stage. They've started like a year or 2 years ago, but they are all looking at everything from general purpose to like special purpose laser communications, looking like, I know that one company is there, they're just looking at like railway networks and how do you innovate railway networks with laser comms, right? There's one company who's just looking at deep space and like, okay, how do you do connect these 3 points and stuff, and which is great. And one of those companies is actually Google. Google X started a few years ago under Sergey and Larry. They started this team called Tara. And then a year ago, they started another company called Alaria, both looking at laser comms. So it's great to be validated like that. And it finally is awesome because there's more education about laser comms going. Otherwise, it was just me sitting just like calling up people is like, hey, do you want a whiteboard session on how laser comms works? Telcos and stuff. So I think that's amazing. And there's more articles and stuff. So I think that kind of guarantees, because, you know, and I'll end this on this line. As a civilization, right, at any given point in time, if you look at, if you think about quantum mechanics, right, and you have, it says that you have, at any given point of time, a quantum particle can have multiple paths of getting to a destination, right? So as a civilization, I've always felt the same. Like, we, at any given point in time, can take any direction that we want, right? Like, civilization can be like, let's say, we can stop going out into space and we can all become VR people, like just go into virtual reality, and computers can sustain all our entertainment needs forever, right? By the way, that's one of the solutions to the Fermi paradox. But the second that people have stood, there's a civilization that just stop expanding beyond because they discover virtual reality. But on the other side, so there's many such things, and I'm happy that on the comms side, on the communications side, there's many technologies we could have gone down. And finally, I'm convinced, and I was scared of that for the first 4 years of starting Transcelestial. And the last 2 years, that fear has gone away because I feel as a world and as a civilization, even if Transcelestial dies today, that laser communications as a technology has been established and is the path that we have now shifted the civilization towards. Like, I mean, there's big SIs like Ericsson and Huawei and stuff who have started laser comms team within their organizations as well, looking at this technology. So I think we have successfully been able to, at least in this area, move the civilization into the right path. And I feel really happy for our band of merry people in Singapore to have led that. Yeah.
Fantastic. That is such a great note to be ending the chat. And I'm very happy that I think you are a pioneer in laser comms. And I'm so happy to have you on my podcast. Thank you, Rohit.
Yeah, I'm so happy that we got to meet and interact. And I'm pretty sure we are going to keep building this friendship.